But our laboratory is in charge basically of all aerodynamics.
Mm-hmm.
It means aerodynamic theory and development, contributions towards specific vehicle systems.
Mm-hmm.
Then we are in charge of flight mechanics in general, that involves control problems, trajectory shaping, and guidance,
mm-hmm.
development of guidance concepts, also guidance and control concepts.
Mm-hmm.
The hardware is normally developed in what is now avionics laboratory.
Right.
That we have a division which is concerned with aerospace environment problems, that means the definition of the natural environment as it is encountered by the vehicle. Primarily wind is important, but also to some extent density distribution,
mm-hmm.
the function of altitude. For also testing, flight testing is to a large extent handled in our laboratory insofar as flight testing and planning of flight testing and flight evaluation. The flight mechanics are a kind of frame, you might say. The establishment of the real trajectory as compared to the predicted trajectory is one of the points of departure, which defines the many parameters which are important for engineering evaluation of details of hardware.
Mm-hmm.
So even though at the last reorganization, which was about a year ago, where the Central Systems Engineering Division was established, the flight evaluation as such has been taken into CSE. But during the whole period of the Saturn program, this was exclusively in our laboratory.
Mm-hmm.
And now we are still handling the flight mechanical portion of it,
mm-hmm.
but not the central flight evaluation.
Mm-hmm.
So that is about, you may want to have a look at the air physics division in terms of aerodynamics.
Mm-hmm.
We also have developed and are operating a number of facilities, as you know, wind tunnels. So they are handled there. Then aerodynamics and guidance theory division is in charge of flight mechanics, that means performance optimization and development of guidance schemes.
Mm-hmm.
Then emission planning and analysis division, which also handles in flight mechanics, and primarily here is more the principles and the mathematical schemes, and here is more the actual planning of flight testing, and also in the operational phase, the responsibility for establishing operational trajectories. And dynamics and control division.
Mm-hmm.
Treat special dynamic problems and control problems.
Mm-hmm.
Control as opposed to guidance, I don't know whether you know this distinction. Guidance essentially is to make the flight path go to the right point, and control is to handle the attitude of the vehicle to make sure that the moments around the CG are balanced and then it will go in the right direction. So this is a kind of necessary condition. If you handle a trajectory as a point mass trajectory, you can handle it simply with guidance theory, but if you consider it as a finite body, three-dimensional body, with moments acting around, you have to go into the control graph.
Mm-hmm.
And finally, the aerospace environment division is the one which is concerned with environmental conditions, density and other natural factors influencing the flight.
Mm-hmm.
So we have broken it into terrestrial environment close to the ground and the atmospheric dynamics, and the space environment, which is far out for satellite type.
Mm-hmm.
So this was pretty much, even though the organization was had minor modifications, but it was pretty much the scheme through all those years,
mm-hmm.
Our contribution. The actual early planning of projects was normally handled in a different office for the division. I don't recall the exact name at the time that the Saturn project started, but it's what is now called the preliminary PD,
Program Development.
Mm-hmm.
The Saturn Systems Office, maybe that's what it
is. No, the Saturn Systems Office is more a place which is in charge of a particular project from a management point of view,
mm-hmm.
more to put it all together. This is more, you might call, a disciplinary setup here, and you know other laboratories, the avionics laboratory, and what is now called propulsion and vehicle engineering, or now it's an structural mechanics laboratory. And now all those, we have in our laboratory a systems and project office. These are a number of people who are projectized. In other words, there is a man or two men or a number of people just working on Saturn 1 or on Saturn 5 or now on the shuttle program.
Mm-hmm.
And they work together then with a centralized systems office. So we might say it's a matrix type organization where an input according to projects and input according to disciplines, and they cross each other. So it's kind of complex,
mm-hmm.
in that respect. Now, in the earlier times, the scheme was not as clearly in focus, even though we had something of this. For instance, the Saturn office was established already after the downstream sometimes. We had the concept of the Saturn was fairly well defined,
mm-hmm.
as far as I recall. But we had always an equivalent to the present PD. I think it was called Advanced Project Office or something like that, or Future Project Office.
Mm-hmm.
And at the time when the Saturn was conceived first, it was under Mr. Keller. And if I'm correct, at the early time, really, this was even a part of another laboratory, which is the structural mechanics, the present structural mechanics laboratory, but then it was put on a separate basis and called it directly to von Braun.
Mm-hmm.
Von Braun used to have a pretty strong interest in the conceptualization of new projects. So it was kind of loosely at that time. We worked with those people, but at the same time, whenever a question proved to be more complex and required more in-depth analysis, we got the laboratory.
Mm-hmm.
So it's hard to say who really conceptualized the thing. I would say the very first idea is probably originated in that cooperation between von Braun and the Advanced Project Office.
Mm-hmm.
The idea of clustering, for instance, that was one of the clustering.
That question intrigues us.
Yeah.
The fact that the clustering, as we understand it, or the first Saturn one was really designed
yeah.
just to test the clustering. It was not designed as a flight vehicle. And
well,
after they had
designed a vehicle, you want to fly it. But you mean not an operational vehicle in the sense of
maybe
the
that's it. Maybe that's
yeah.
it. Yes,
I
because
think
we were talking
to
yes, yeah. we were talking to Rostick the other day.
Yeah.
He made
yeah.
this point that if they had really planned for a series of flight missions, you know.
Yeah.
Realistically, it would have been a different design
oh,
than
yeah.
what it really was.
Well, I guess the problem was to some extent that at the time when the Saturn was started, Saturn 1, the concept that was still under ARPA, it was under the Army Advanced Research, I don't know what it's called.
Project Agency,
ARPA.
Yeah, ARPA. Mm-hmm.
And they were anxious to get into larger rockets,
mm-hmm.
larger space vehicles, or they called it still rockets at that time.
Mm-hmm.
It was a military organization. They had just the feeling this was necessary, but they had not a clear-cut mission for that larger vehicle at that time. They had a strong feeling it would be useful for military purposes or other purposes, and also be developed, but there was a lack of a defined mission, a payload,
mm-hmm.
at that time. And later then, and that was, if I remember correctly, approximately in 1958, this concept was about started,
mm-hmm.
under ARPA. And then in 1960, there was the decision by President Kennedy to land a man on the moon.
Mm-hmm.
And then, since the C-1 cluster concept was already, to some extent, it was not a developed vehicle, but it was reasonably advanced, at least the engineering design, it was decided to make this a building step towards a larger orbit. It was recognized pretty soon that this rocket was too small
mm-hmm.
to really accomplish a manned lunar landing. And the feeling was probably one should not make too big a step from the previous vehicle. The largest vehicle was about the Jupiter vehicle, which we had, the IRBM. And they felt we might have to go in two or maybe even three steps towards a vehicle, a rocket which would be big enough to serve for the lunar landing
mm-hmm.
mission. And there was now a whole, I would say, number of years, it was pretty unclear. Sometimes we postulated a whole family of intermediate C1, C2, C3, C5, and finally Nova.
Mm-hmm.
It was a fairly complex and tortuous and indirect approach. Because the C1 was, the cluster concept was started at a time when the manned lunar landing mission was not yet postulated. And later when it was, then the question was, how big a step can you make at one time?
Mm-hmm.
Would you develop the whole family of intermediate rockets? And as it developed, actually, we went through three stages, you might say, two intermediate stages, the C1 and the, what we call now the Saturn 1B vehicle.
Mm-hmm.
There are models over there.
Yeah.
They're different scales.
Yeah, I see that. The Saturn 5 is a little low there.
The Saturn 5 is. Now, to some extent, there are some stages of those rockets are used as common elements. For instance, the
mm-hmm.
second stage on the 7-1B, the so-called S4B stage, is the third stage on the 7-5.
Mm-hmm.
It is powered by one J2 engine. And but now as to philosophy, really, the cluster concept first was felt to be the quickest way, relatively cheap, to get to the more powerful orbit.
Mm-hmm.
Just combining a number of existing orbits more than only the structures. Yeah? But then it was also recognized that this would be a very complex operation. You have a large number of engines, and even the structural dynamics of such a vehicle, where tanks join together, is fairly complex. The prediction of the dynamic characteristics, how it deforms, what frequencies and motions it would have, is pretty difficult. And
more difficult than on a single tank instrument?
It is more difficult, yes. Mm-hmm. And actually, we learned a lot in going through the flight. There was a plan for 10 flights of this Saturn 1. Actually, they flew not all of them, but most of them, I think 7 or 8 were flown. And we learned a lot about theoretical treatment, how to predict the elastic characteristics of such a vehicle. And this is important because there is a fairly strong connection between the control actually and the structural dynamics.
Mm-hmm.
We have our sensors, certain gyros or accelerometers, which activate our control systems, our swivel engines. And if they are placed in a location in the vehicle which is due to the control effect, which is the torque acting on the vehicles, it may be deformed, and then it may be a vicious feedback. It may kind of get unstable and make the vehicle swing more and more and suddenly break up or something like that. So it is pretty important that one is capable and advanced to specify, to say what are the various mode shapes, the frequencies and mode shapes, how does it deflect and with what frequency, and then one can place the sensors in the control system in proper locations so as to make sure that such an instability would not occur in flight.
Did you find that you were placing sensors in much different positions on the S1 and S1B as opposed to the Saturn V?
Yes, we had to really treat each of those vehicles individually, and the experience we gained was not to say we put it in a particular location, but the experience we gained with each step was the basic techniques.
Mm-hmm.
What equations to use, what kind of simulation techniques. So we had methods developed which we could apply to the next stage, but we could normally not apply immediate results.
Mm-hmm.
As a matter of fact, now also the aerodynamic properties, the stability properties of those vehicles are different. Actually, even in Saturn Block 1 and Block 2, Block 1 was an unstable configuration with very small fins, as you will see from the model.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
The one, Block 2 was the one with a fairly big fin. Now, the reason for introducing those fins was that we started even for Saturn 1. We started eventually after we were downstream somewhat to talk about the mission, and that was, I think, the first thing, a manned mission was a dinosaur.
Mm-hmm.
That was the final reason that we put those fins on, because we said, in case of a failure, suppose there would be a control failure during flight. If the vehicle was naturally stable, it means it, even if the control system doesn't work, if you switch it off, you coast along with a reasonable angle of attack. Whereas an unstable vehicle, where the center of pressure is ahead of the center of gravity, would turn over, break up, and within maybe a few seconds, you could really have a complete structural failure and would not be capable of getting off the vehicle with maybe a parachute or something.
Mm-hmm.
So this was the prime reason why we put those fins on the Saturn 1.
Mm-hmm.
Now the dinosaur mission, I don't know how long we worked on this, but it was a fairly thorough study. We went into all kinds of analysis of that thing for, I would guess, about 3/4 of a year. But I couldn't tell you exactly when it was.
62.
It was canceled. 62 only.
Yeah.
But it was probably, we made a fairly concentrated study, and then there was a long time in which it was kind of interspersed. We didn't know exactly how it would continue.
Mm-hmm.
Saturn 1B, let's see how that goes now. Yeah, second stage, actually one rationale or one argument for the Saturn was also, since we wanted to go into hydrogen as a propellant, in contrast to the LOX-RP,
mm-hmm.
just cryogenic, because of the higher high specific. Actually, we said those vehicles would be good test vehicles just to check the technology of hydrogen.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So the first stage, the second stage in Saturn 1 was the first step in that direction. That was what we call the S4 stage,
mm-hmm.
which was powered with RL-10 engine. Mm-hmm. First it was standard with 4 on, and later it was increased to 6 of the engine.
Mm-hmm.
And we even thought about the third stage on Saturn C1 first, which was called the S5 stage, and we even had a contract with Convair.
No, the Centaur, they used the Centaur on there?
I'm not sure. I think, yes, at one time, but I think then you were also talking about using this one RL-10.
Mm-hmm.
I couldn't tell you for sure now.
Mm-hmm.
But this then did not materialize. It was decided not to do away with the third stage, and we had a new engine, which was a J2,
yeah.
A more powerful engine developed by North American, which I think was started was on other purpose. I couldn't tell you. I don't think it was just developed for us here. I think it was an Air Force development.
They got drew a lot of their technology out of some previous
development. Yeah, which was around 200,000 or more pounds.
Yeah.
And then the concept was to change the original idea of an S4 stage to an S4B stage, which would be powered with one J2.
Mm-hmm.
And that is the second stage in the S1B, the second one of our family. The first stage is pretty much the same as in the Saturn 1.
Mm-hmm.
It's still a cluster, as you see, the smaller one.
Yeah.
And
mm-hmm.
the H1 was somewhat upgraded from 165 to 188K or so. This together with the S4B was then the test stage for the S4B, and at that time already we then had it, I guess, converged towards the concept for the Saturn V, which was considered the launch vehicle for the lunar vehicle, and decided that S4B would be a good third stage for the Saturn V. So we would, with the S1B, get experience on the second stage for the Saturn V.
Mm-hmm.
And we also figured this vehicle could carry a fairly substantial payload into orbit, large enough that we could conduct re-entry tests for orbital payloads. That means for payloads which would be representative of a payload coming back from the moon,
mm-hmm.
with some extra propulsion on the way down. We could approach speeds approaching what we call parabolic re-entry speed. That means the speed coming back not from Earth orbit, but coming back from the moon, which is in the order of, I think, somewhat over 10,000 meters per second.
Mm-hmm.
We could not quite reach it. We could reach about 9,000 meters. But that was already considered an effective test to get the first feeling. And also the idea of certain Earth orbital operations on the lunar command module and service module. They are missions for the S1B. Now, all of those, more or less, all of those tests originally were planned even for the Saturn 1, because we had not very good figures on what weights would be needed, and eventually it dawned on us that the weights would be much heavier for re-entry capsules. So actually, and even those orbital operations were planned for the Saturn 1. None of this materialized. So actually, we had all of those flights with practically no payloads, except a few scientific payloads.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we at one time threw up some water.
Yeah,
so
high water.
And
then later on,
and later we had this Pegasus that was a micrometeorite program,
mm-hmm.
which was quite useful. It came fairly late as a kind of expedient.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, but the 1B actually served then to flight test the third stage for the Saturn V, and it also served to perform the first Earth orbital manned flight with hardware which really was used then for the final Apollo mission. So
when you were beginning some of these early considerations of bending moments and dynamics, etc., you went through a series using test models, didn't you? Mean small ones, like what would they be, 1/100 scale practically, or something like that, or much less?
You mean for structural dynamics? For aerodynamics. We have to make a distinction here.
All right,
aerodynamic tests in the wind tunnels are fairly small.
Yeah.
Normally, depending on the size of the wind tunnel, you have something like maybe 1% scale. You know?
Did you do all of the tests here?
No, not all of them. We did normally our wind tunnels are considered pilot facilities. We start our early tests in our tunnels.
Mm-hmm.
That's in your lab, isn't it?
Yes, in our lab. Because we have a very quick response, we don't need much money, we can all do it internally, so to say, and check out the rough feasibility. If the thing looks feasible and works out well, then frequently, or mostly, we go into larger tunnels, into the NASA family, primarily. Not exclusively, but primarily at Langley and at Ames, some testing in Lewis. But also some aircraft companies. It depends then on the whole regime. Well, we have here a tunnel which goes from subsonic to transonic and into a low supersonic flow, but size is somewhat limited. If we want to have really large models, we have to go to other facilities. Especially especially if one wants to test not only the overall cross forces, that means lift, height, and moment, but pressure distribution, that means for loading calculations, the exact distribution of pressure over the structure,
mm-hmm.
then you want to have really big models, because you have to make a lot, bring a lot of gauges, bolts onto the model to pick up sometimes as many as several hundred on one set.
Mm-hmm.
And a small model just wouldn't be practical.
Mm-hmm.
So that was done then together with other centers. We normally, we were pretty much in the lead. We had a high priority with the Apollo program, you know, and we could tell them pretty much what we wanted to have done. It was a somewhat different relation to what it is now. At that time, the research centers were very anxious to accept work which was somehow tied to the Apollo vehicle. It was in a way vital for them to keep it existing.
How long were these aerodynamic model tests continued? That's the 66, 67, 68?
Oh, I would say they continue even beyond beyond the flight test sometimes.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, for the reason that you still have special certain special problems and don't always get very good results from flight. Even though a flight test, of course, basically is more meaningful because you can only then really fully simulate all parameters. In wind tunnel testing, you normally simulate well, the geometric similarity, of course, and the Mach number. That means the ratio of the speed to the speed of sound is considered incompressible, so the most important, for high speed, the most important simulation. But the Reynolds number, which is the ratio of the frictional forces to the inertial forces of the air around, normally has to be compromised. You could, in most tunnels, you have to stay fairly low, below the free flight values. In other words, you can only reach sometimes 1%, sometimes 10% of the Reynolds numbers, which are experienced in full flight, free flight. And it was the opinion for a long time of many people that that didn't matter as long as if you had turbulent flow. For low Reynolds numbers, you have laminar flow, and that is very important to simulate the Reynolds number correctly, especially if you want to know whether you get the transition from laminar flow to turbulent flow. And that transition is a very complex subject, really. I could talk hours about it here, and couldn't even tell you what it is exactly.
Uh-huh.
Roughly speaking, you may say at a certain Reynolds number normally you get transition, but whether you get it at a specific Reynolds number depends on the body shape, it depends on the angle of attack, it depends on the turbulence in the atmosphere and vibrations and all kinds of factors. Yeah?
Mm-hmm.
And that's even today not fully understood. And but the feeling was once you got into turbulence flow, the dependence upon Reynolds number was only a weak one, a mild one. And that is correct for many cases, but not for all of them, and it was recognized partially through our work on Saturn V, but partially also from on related aircraft, let's say unrelated aircraft work and transonic flight, that there are certain phenomena for certain configurations where even at higher turbulence flow, the Reynolds number may be quite important. They produce drastic effects in terms of pressure, for instance. Certain transonic airplanes, the center of pressure may suddenly shift substantially, and you may get an overturning moment and so forth.
Hmm.
Now, based on this, we had a campaign, and that was several years campaign to make an argument for the need for high Reynolds number test facilities. I happen to be a member of a NASA advisory research committee for space vehicle aerodynamics since 57. First it was for space, for rockets and space vehicles, and later it was specialized to space vehicles. And I used this committee as a sounding board, and was together there with senior people from the NASA family and also from industry to sell this concept. Succeeded, I don't recall, but halfway in the development of the setup, we succeeded in selling this concept, and we are authorized then to build here a kind of pilot facility for high Reynolds number testing, which is we use the principle which was introduced in Germany by Professor Ludwig in Göttingen, Ludwig Tube.
Mm-hmm.
It's a fairly cheap and fairly simple thing. We invested not much more than $500,000, and I now have a facility which can test the highest Reynolds numbers. In the Western world. Now, the argument was that we had large angles of attack for the Saturn V, we could not predict really the loading conditions in a certain abnormal cases, in a broad case, so that where we could lose control. We could have predicted more accurately when a man would have to leave the vehicle, abort the vehicle, and things of that nature. Unfortunately, it was not. It didn't turn out that it was needed, really, but So we would anyway have come a little too late. It took us too long to get this concept approved before the facility is just now starting to get into a productive stage. And it happens to be very useful for our new project, that is the shuttle now we are working. Because the shuttle has even higher dynamic pressures than the Saturn V has, and it's probably critically dependent on this. So we are very glad that we could introduce this facility there. But
I was going to ask you if there are any close parallels between testing and the results of tests of aircraft models in such a tunnel as opposed to a rocket structure. They seem so totally dissimilar.
Yes, you might say in the beginning the whole effect of aerodynamics is in a way less critical for a rocket than it is for an airplane.
Mm-hmm.
There is the difference. I'm not saying it's unimportant, but we have such a powerful propulsion system and the effect of aerodynamic forces, let's say aerodynamic drag, for instance, is, I wouldn't say negligible, but it's a kind of second iteration.
Mm-hmm.
You could make a very rough guess neglecting it or making a very rough estimate of your drag and would get pretty good performance data. Now, as for stability, that means the location of center of pressure with respect to the CG is different. We have to know this pretty accurately because we have to control our system. So
okay,
we have to know. Mm-hmm. But, the prediction of aerodynamic drag, which is in a way even more difficult because aerodynamic drag is even less accessible to theoretical treatment. We have a number of expressions for skin drag and forward drag on the body, but the base drag, for instance, where we have suction in, at the end of the body, is even today almost accessible only to experimental approaches. Unfortunately, we developed techniques, or novel techniques, to get a handle on this, but fortunately, those things did not require the same accuracy as you would need for an airplane in particular performance, because on the airplane, it's an equilibrium between your propulsion and your drag, and your total performance is direct proportional to the drag. So if you make a 10% error, you have at least a 10% less performance or worse. That is not correct in our case.
Mm-hmm.
We want to know it, we have to know it, but not as accurately. Otherwise, the basic tools, of course, and theories are pretty much the same between rockets and airplanes, but the emphasis on different shapes and the working knowledge, I mean, the experimental portion, aerodynamics is largely an experimental science where you combine a little theoretical concept with measurement and touch factors and this kind of thing. In that respect, we had to establish new experience, it was different from airplanes.
Mm-hmm.
But of course, we still based much of our work on existing aircraft technology and knowledge.
It just seems to me, looking back on it, that the Saturn I and the 1B are just kind of horrible examples of aerodynamic design.
Yes, I mean, normally the aerodynamics was the kind of stepchild where we could just mightily register our concern about the bad shape, but it was frequently ignored, and only afterwards we then came to the bill and that's what you have to pay for it. And in some cases, it is not so much the boss performance, but there are such things, for instance, unsteady aerodynamics, aerodynamic noise, especially out in the transonic regime on Mach 1, if you have protuberances, and we have plenty of protuberances for antennas or certain heads and openings or exhausts,
mm-hmm.
they can produce a very terrific amount of local vibration, especially Mach 1 noise. It's normally expressed in decibels, and our decibel level is aerodynamically about as high as the decibel level at the ground when the rocket motor starts, it shakes everything. That's tremendous, you know? It really goes to the limit of some materials. And we have a few spots, and if we don't shape it properly, then we get in flight again. It's very high, maximum dynamic pressure. Very high of degree of excitation. So this was an area which was considerably worked upon. And this is something which you cannot do too well in small tunnels. We have to go into very large tunnels in order to simulate them. Low field as influenced by the body as a large, but also introduce all the small protuberances and so forth, and really have lots of exact measurements.
Well, there's not only that, there are all the separate tanks in there, and you had air patterns around.
The flow through those tanks was pretty tricky. And,
yeah.
One time we were very much concerned that there might not be a lot of hydrogen which may leak from the upper stage. Yeah? As a matter of fact, they have to vent some hydrogen prior to starting the engine.
Mm-hmm.
And the question, how much would accumulate between those tanks? There are kind of dead water regions where you wake, where the thing may accumulate.
Mm-hmm.
There was a concern that it might start to burn or explode or something. Yeah.
Mm.
So we had, for several years, fairly careful studies. It was a mix of experimental and theoretical studies.